Пришли на телеканал
«Дождь». Пришла проверить канал «Дождь».
Три года колонии общего режима
Ильдара Дадина, человека, который называется...
Задержали Ильдара Дадина.
Михаила Ходорковского хотят видеть в России.
Отцу Ходорковского, проживающего...
Федеральный розыск объявлен бывший глава ЮКОСа Михаил Ходорковский. Об этом сообщает...
A raid on an opposition television station, a harsh sentence for an anti-government protester, fresh charges against a longtime Kremlin foe, and reports that the authorities are making emergency plans to secure government buildings in the event of unrest. 4 years ago this week, the largest anti-Kremlin demonstration since the fall of the Soviet Union broke out in Moscow. And despite Vladimir Putin's sky-high poll numbers and a wave of patriotic fervor sweeping the country, the Kremlin appears increasingly worried that as Russia's recession deepens, people could again take to the streets. Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City is Mark Gagliotti, a professor at NYU, an expert on Russian security services, and author of the blog In Moscow's Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
Hi there, guys.
And also joining us via Skype from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies, author of Sean's Russia blog, and host of the SRB podcast. Welcome back, Sean.
Thanks for having me.
It's good to have the old team back here. So we've had a raid on Dosh TV, a harsh three-year sentence handed down to Ildar Dadin for repeatedly attended anti-government protests. That's the first time that so-called three strikes you're out law came into was actually enforced, and fresh charges against two sets of fresh charges against Mikhail Hodorkovsky. We've also had a new arrest in the three-year-old Bolotnaya case, Dmitry Buchenkov, who was detained last week. And all of this is happening in the context of a continuing protest by Russia's long-haul truckers. Mark, you indicated that you think the truckers' protest is important when we were talking off mic this week. Does it look to you that the Kremlin is increasingly worried about mass protests when you take all of these things together that I mentioned in the intro? And if so, is that fear justified?
Well, I think two things, really. One is I actually ought to admit that precisely this has been historically my hobby horse, the extent to which I think it's labor unrest, which is going to be the biggest issue for the Kremlin rather than political unrest. And secondly, it's that we should realize that it's worrisome not because we're going to see a Maidan. I think that's highly unlikely. Or if there is going to be a Maidan, it's something that the authorities could handle. It's more what that says. It's actually that labor unrest is, for me, the best index we have about the real feelings of the people. It's one of the very, very few ways they can actually express it. Because they all know that elections don't matter. They still regard Putin as some kind of disembodied secular saint of the nation. And one of the only ways they can acquire agency is by doing things on very, very specific and often very local issues. And I think we're seeing a few little sort of signs. I do think it was one of the subtexts of Putin's State of the Federation speech. The very fact that he was pushing the economy, and yes, of course, he wants the economy to improve because then he gets the ability to buy shiny toys for the military and have foreign ventures and everything else. But the way he was pushing it much more as something that, you've got to fight corruption, you've got to fight red tape, you've got to actually sort of encourage all more economic dynamism and such like. He made it very, very clear the extent to which he acknowledges that the fate of his regime is very much linked to the fate of the economy. And then we actually see some quite specific signs. The way that the Kremlin tends to respond is through a mix. On the one hand, there's repression. It's not about mass oppression. It's about specific, targeted, symbolic deterrent acts. And so in this case, Ildar Dadin's case is obviously sort of particularly relevant. And it'll be interesting to see also how they deal with the truckers or whatever. But it's also about making sure that they have the resources to hand. One of my sort of little hobby horses is watching the coverage of First Interior Minister Viktor Zolotov, Putin's former bodyguard, judo sparring partner, and now clearly put in place within the Interior Minister in case they need to have a sort of a senior leg breaker in chief. And there's every now and then bubbling up stories about, actually Zolotov about to become the Interior Minister. Mm-hmm. It's not so much that I think he necessarily will, because I think nothing else, that would be exceedingly unpopular within the police force and quite worrying to a lot of other people. It's more that just simply the mentions of Zolotov, the hints that he might become the main guy in charge of all the police and so forth, are, again, a bit of a warning and a bit of a signal of that the Kremlin is thinking in these terms. And they're spending. The Interior Ministry has had to take a 10% cut across the board this year. Now, something I'd heard for a while now is actually that the Amon, their funds have been ring-fenced. So, in other words, the riot police, the guys who would be at the front line, they're still getting the same resources they were before, which, of course, means a disproportionate cut to the other elements. I mean, a little snippet of this. We heard the other day that the Russians are ordering more of something called the RGS-50M, which is a grenade launcher, which is used essentially to fire tear gas and rubber bullets and stun grenades. And they're actually going to increase the number they have fivefold. So at the very time they're having to cut their budgets, they're very specifically spending on riot control kit, which is very much for the Amon. So in a way, one side of it, the sticks are clearly being prepared.
They're preparing the sticks, yeah, exactly.
And also being waived. I mean, I think that, you know, it's an important point how far the press coverage is significant. Just be aware we have large sticks. But then there's also the carrot side. I mean, and you mentioned this fascinating little sort of snippet that came out about the extent to which the FSO,
yes,
the Praetorian Guard of the Kremlin is actually being involved in a team who are looking at, on a very granular local level, color coding where they find regions which actually have growing levels of local unrest, and then targeting them for state handouts and such like, which again is a classic way of sort of trying to parachute in to deal with it.
Odd that the FSO is doing that, though? I find it odd. Maybe you can explain to me why it's not odd.
Well, two things. I mean, one is it's only part of the team. It's not actually running it. But secondly, the FSO has acquired this interesting role and we're plugging a lot of gaps. You know, it clearly envisages its idea of protecting the Kremlin and protecting the regime in very broad terms.
Very broad terms, yeah.
The interesting thing, I mean, you know,
as broad as 1/6 of the Earth's landmass, one might say.
And which security agency in Russia doesn't try and expand its remit? But like very specifically, the guy in charge who's actually transitioning out to retirement, Murov, in many ways emerged as the sort of shadow national security advisor as well, because part of the FSO's remit is actually to answer the question who watches the watchers and look at the security apparatus. And clearly, over the years, and he's the most long-serving of any of the security chiefs within Russia. Over the years, he acquired this role as, in some ways, one could almost put it as the security services fact checker, in the sense of when they brief Putin, and he's thinking, well, actually, they're briefing for their own personal interest. They're briefing beyond what the actual data suggests. He's the one who whispers in Putin's ear, you might want to get them to actually come back to you on that, which wasn't ever part of his formal remit. It was just that he saw that there was a problem in the sense of the more the intelligence services get to misbrief Putin, then the more the danger is, then that leads to bad policy with all the following implications. And so he stepped into that role. So I think this isn't just another way in which the FSO, when it sees a gap, steps in to try and deal with it.
Is there a stick element to that too? Because this, at the end of the day, this is the Kremlin's Praetorian Guard. I mean, at the end of the day, them doling out social welfare, keeping tabs on regions, color coding them in terms of where there's going to be social unrest. We're talking about the FSO at the end of the day. Is there a stick here too?
Not really. I mean, the FSO is too small. And, you know, the FSB, the Federal Security Service, has ample sticks at its disposal. And in that respect, I mean, this is the point. The FSB is good at doing the beating people over the head and locking them up side of things. It has neglected something which we must remember the KGB used to do. I mean, this is something that the KGB used to run the best opinion polls in the Soviet Union. Obviously, they didn't have people with clipboards saying, hello, I'm from the KGB, can ask you a few questions about how happy. But, you know, through a whole variety of front structures and so forth, because they realized they would be, and indeed they were, at the front line if things actually went wrong. So, you know, particularly under Yuri Andropov, may his name be praised, you know, who actually was a very unyielding but also clear-thinking security chief. Mm-hmm. They actually built this whole apparatus for basically what it was called prophylactic operations, which is a rather unfortunate term. for actually spotting problems
in the Russian language, that has a different meaning. Actually,
I know. But, you know, for spotting problems before they would emerge and deciding from a whole spectrum of possible responses, from bringing someone in for a chat all the way to actually dealing with a problem in a more positive way. Well, given that the FSB has neglected that, actually what we're seeing is the FSO stepping in, just simply because it sees a gap there, because other people can handle the stick side of the equation.
Sean, your thoughts? Are the Kremlin's fears justified? And then on anything else, well, Mark had to say there.
Yeah, first I want to comment on the FSO and add that it is also a way to to circumvent local channels of information. Right, I think Mark is also touched on this a bit, that if you send out guys from the Kremlin to kind of monitor the attitudes of the population, you get a couple of things. One, you get, you know, a less filtered, not an unfiltered, but a less filtered sense of what the mood of the population is. That is a direct channel to, you know, Putin's administration. So you don't have to deal with all of the redactions of reports and various and less internal interests of structures within the police apparatus. But also you circumvent local government, because one of the things is that local administration in Russia has been bled pretty badly in terms of its funds. Local debt of local government is increasing. A friend of mine just posted a chart on Facebook that since the Kremlin has basically giving less money to the regions, local debt has increased. So there's a question of, do they actually have the means? And then if you to deal with kind of local dissatisfaction, to dole out these kind of economic goodies, but also then you circumvent the local corruption as a way to dole out these things. So I think using these mechanisms are, you know, ways to circumvent certain gaps and problems and stop gaps within the power vertical itself.
Let me flip let me flip that on its head for a second, though, because this is something I raised this morning in the Daily Vertical, is that isn't the fact of the federal security, the Federal Guard Service going out and doling out social welfare, shouldn't this be done by social welfare agencies? And if they have to fill gaps there, doesn't it say the state's to a degree dysfunctional?
Well, I mean, it to a certain extent, yeah. I mean, local government in Russia is fairly dysfunctional. It's not incredibly responsive to local you know, issues. I mean, this is one of the problems. But also, using these mechanisms also bestows, you know, legitimacy to Putin, that his guys are doling out these things, right? So it I think it has also a kind of, you know, quasi propaganda function in this sense. But I think it's well shared amongst most, you know, Russian elites that the local government doesn't work very effectively. Right. And this goes to, I think, why the truckers' protest is really important. It's not because this is going to necessarily lead to something greater. You know, it's hard to say whether that happens. But these people, you know, are essentially these truckers. They're independent businessmen, a lot of them. They're from the provinces. They're Putin's people. And you can, if you look at the statements by a lot of them, the testimonies, and I translated one for Open Democracy, I highly recommend reading that. You get a sense that they're expecting a response by the Kremlin.
Yeah.
You know, they're supporters of Putin. There was an RFE article too that kind of had quotes from one of these guys that spoke to this too.
It was almost as if Putin only knew. All their anger was directed at Medvedev and the government. If Putin only knew. And I mean, I think somebody actually said that.
Yeah, there's elements of this too. There's elements of this kind of naive monarchism. But they were expecting some kind of response, and they were looking at Putin's speech and expecting him to address them directly. Right. And they didn't.
He didn't touch it.
He didn't touch it at all. And this caused a lot of dissatisfaction, particularly the fact that the protest, you know, is wider than just kind of saying we don't want to pay this road tax because it's going to add extra costs on us. It's the fact that, you know, the son of Putin's judo partner owns half the company collecting the taxes.
Who's collecting a fat 20% commission.
Exactly. Exactly. But I think this is really important, because they're Putin's people, they're Putin's supporters, they're from the provinces. But I think it's even more important because these guys see the country.
Yeah.
They use the infrastructure. And if you read what they're saying, their complaints are about roads, the fact that here they're getting this extra tax, and what are they paying it for? The roads are a complete disaster. The infrastructure is disaster. They see the villages, they see the small towns, they deal with local businesses, they have to pay bribes to police. They are really in the kind of guts of Russian life.
Right. Do you see this as a harbinger?
I don't know if it's a harbinger as much as it is. It gives a perspective on Russia that it opens up the possibility of a Russia that we don't normally hear or see.
Mm.
And it kind of the truckers' protest has put that image more on the front. And Levada Center came out with a poll, I think it was yesterday or a couple of days ago, where almost 80% of Muscovites support this truckers' protest.
80% of Muscovites. I didn't see
almost.
That.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. That's what, interesting. So I think the social economic issues speak to people's daily lives more. Another thing, znak.com, which is a great website because it deals with provincial news, did an article 2 days ago where they compared prices from November 2014 to prices now in grocery stores. And they did a receipt comparison, and they're finding that despite the projections that inflation is like 10%, 15% at max, that some of the products are going up by 20, 30%. And things like, you know, vegetables, meat, cheese, these kinds of things, the staples that people are buying. And these are in the provinces, which I think is always important to keep in mind, because, again, this is Putin's base.
Right.
So what it's speaking to, it's not necessarily – I wouldn't interpret it as like a harbinger for things to come. But I think what it's going to do is put more pressure on the Kremlin to actually respond to these things. Because one of the interesting things, if you look at over the last, you know, decade or so, the Kremlin has been mildly far more responsive to these types of grumblings. You know, if you think back to the response to the 2005 monetization of benefits, they responded. And it's also interesting the way they deal with these protests is far different than, say, how they deal with, you know, the kind of liberal kind of opposition, Doge TV, people like this. They're kind of kid's gloves. They arrest these guys. They prevent their trucks from, you know, coming into and joining.
Well, they play divide and rule.
They play all these games, but they're not cracking down hard on them.
No.
And I think that this is another signal in terms of that the Kremlin is, as you correctly point, they are sensitive, but they all are also quite responsive.
Yeah, no, I mean, this is all happening, as you pointed out, the price is rising. This is happening, and for the first time in Putin's presidency, real incomes are falling. Real incomes are falling.
Yes,
and
this, the purchasing power
purchasing
has fallen,
power fallen for the first
like
time,
a third in some cases.
Since it's the first time in Putin's presidency. The way I framed this on the blog is that it's basically Putin has to choose between his two bases here. The truckers are his popular base. They're kind of a metaphor for his popular base. And Igor Rotenberg is a metaphor, you know, the son of Arkady is a metaphor for his elite base, right?
And another thing I want to add, too, that came out in Kommersant 2 days ago, that they're forming – so the big issue, one of the big economic issues, and I think the oil price is putting extra pressure on this, is that they have to raise the pension age.
Yeah.
This has been the plan for a long time. Yeah. And Kommersant had an article three days ago, that they're forming this kind of quasi-civil society commission to examine, you know, the pension, raising the pension age, which of course is complete smokescreen because they're going to eventually raise it anyways.
Right.
But they're going through these motions to say, well, we're trying to build some kind of social consensus by having all of these representatives from various aspects of, you know, society, you know, to look at this issue.
A classic Pakazuka.
I mean, in a lot of cases, that's like, yeah, sure.
Mark, I see you're writing, which means you're thinking and means you're going to say something. Go for it.
Well, it was interesting. You asked whether this is a harbinger, and the, you know, honest answer is we may not think so, but we don't know. But I think this is the point. I suspect that likewise in the Kremlin, that whenever something like this bubbles up, they're thinking, is this a harbinger? Because they don't know either. And I think this is why it's symbolic, and it sort of comes to Moscow, and this is where everything matters. It's when it comes to Moscow.
The provinces came to Moscow in big trucks.
Exactly, it's visible, it's physical, and all this means that it actually has to be addressed, because, I mean, one knows that certainly within the Soviet apparatus, they were haunted for decades by Novocherkassk, the Novocherkassk uprising 1962, when just simply the random malign confluence of various factors, local factory reducing its piece rate norms, so in other words, in practice, people's salaries suffered, same day food prices were increased, local security apparatus refused to crack down, and the whole thing sort of metastasized, and then they sent in security forces and people started getting killed and lots of people started being locked up. And the whole point about Novocherkassk was that it was nowhere special. It wasn't a particular...
It was a monocity.
No, it was a monocity, but precisely how many of those were there scattered? Exactly. So the sense was almost, well, if it could happen in Novocherkassk, how many other places could it happen? What would have happened if it had happened in three places at the same time instead of one, where you can't just rush in your security forces? I mean, I don't know if they still actually use the idiom of Novocherkassk in those conversations.
It comes up in the press a lot.
Exactly, but there's certainly no sign that it's actually disappeared. And so I think this is something that the Kremlin has to work with. They don't know either. For all their, FSO and other people trying to penetrate and everything else, they never quite know when something will simply become this symbolic act. I mean, it's fascinating, as Sean mentioned, that they're sort of coming in and saying, if only Putin knew. Well, we ought to remember that the most dramatic example of that kind of, if we only can get through to the Tsar,
right,
the Tsar will fix it all, is after all what led to Bloody Sunday Massacre and the 1905 revolution. And again, I'm not for a moment saying that there's going to be the grand 2016 revolution, whatever Khodorkovsky may say. But the point is the possibilities that any of these things can actually become that little piece of grit around which the whole pearl sort of coalesces is something that the Kremlin can never, ever be sure about. And this is why, again, going back to your issue about shouldn't it be the local authorities, the social support structures and so forth who deal with this rather than the kind of Kremlin task forces. But the point is, this is not just simply about poverty. This is not just simply about need. This is actually about when poverty or need have created a situation where they regard it as being potentially politically dangerous. And there they will throw resources, whereas this other place may well be equally impoverished, but there's no signs of any particular protest movement, so to hell with them. They'll just have to like it or lump it.
Go ahead.
So I think this is what it comes together as suggesting, that one way or the other, the Kremlin cannot afford not to deal with these protests. And absolutely, as you say, they have to deal with them in a much more considerate manner. They can't just try and lock people up in large numbers, because this is a very different kind of movement.
Right. Now, this isn't going to get any better. Brent crude fell below 40 today. And it's not going to go back up, regardless of what the Russian budget forecasts said, predicting it's going to go back up in the summer. Did Putin drop the ball by not bringing this up in his speech? Why ignore it entirely? Because I think that may have gone a long way to quelling this. And he didn't mention it at all, which I was frankly surprised. They were frankly infuriated, the truckers. I mean, did he, I guess both Sean and Mark, did he drop the ball here? What do you think, Mark?
Well, I would say it was this one of these delicate balances, because after all, this is a time when the eyes of the nation are on what Putin is saying, and it's going to be splashed all over the place. Given that they've clearly tried to downplay the truckers' protests, especially on the TV news, it's interesting. I mean, there's much, much more coverage in the press, the print/internet media, than TV. And I suspect that there was a decision made, quite possibly a poor decision, which is precisely to keep it out of the speech, because otherwise you're essentially alerting the country, first of all, that there is this protest going on. And secondly, you are more or less saying to people, come and make a mess in Moscow, and we will deal with it. It might have helped deal with the truckers, but then it would have also, I suppose the potential is, have encouraged other people to realize what is actually the truth of the matter, which is precisely if you come and make enough of a noise in the right place, then probably the Kremlin will have to deal with you.
Mm. Sean, what do you think?
In addition to that, which I think is definitely the case, it also possibly could have pitted what you mentioned earlier, Brian, which is this kind of paradox of the two kind of camps of Putin support against each other. You know, here the truckers from middle Russia against the oligarchs within Putin's circle. So that kind of, and then also in opposition to something that the, you know, the government, you know, put in place. So it could have created that possibility of conflict in the air, where the Kremlin is more intent on suppressing conflict in society and portraying kind of a united society.
Mm. I don't know if either of you saw this interview in Vedomosti with Denis Volkov of Levada. It was an interesting piece, ostensibly about explaining what the polls mean. Essentially, it was reprinted in Medusa as well. But I found it a very fascinating piece, and I wanted to read a passage from it and kind of get a reaction, because I think this gets to the heart of some of what we're talking about. And he writes basically twice in 2005 and 2011 and 2012, Putin's approval ratings fell to 60% due to economic problems. And both times, these slowdowns were accompanied by mass nationwide protests. The thing is that a 60% approval rating means that more than a third of the country is consciously dissatisfied with the authorities, whom Russians are unable to replace through the electoral process. And in circumstances like these, any incident can trigger a chain reaction and unleash open expressions of dissent. It's kind of like the 60% combined with economic trouble. And right now we have the economic trouble. We don't have the 60% yet. We don't have protest yet. But would you agree with that? When a third of the country is kind of opposed to Putin, does that put him in this vulnerable stage? This seems to be what Volkov's saying. Mark, what do you think?
I absolutely would agree, because Putin has this symbolic status. Putin's popularity always is that much greater than government and government policy, because the same opinion polls at the moment that sort of show him at high levels of support show actually a considerable amount of dissatisfaction. You know, when the same people are asked questions like, are you happy with the direction things are going? Are you happy with the government? They're much, much
more
downbeat.
Would you vote for Putin? It's only 55%.
Exactly.
It's only 55.
You know, we get mesmerized
by the 90% or the 89%
exactly,
or whatever. Yeah.
The Putin personal thing. And I always think, I mean, look, you know, one can go back to, for example, Winston Churchill after World War II. You know, this is the guy who had been the figurehead of Britain through the course of the war, the sort of indomitable British bulldog spirit. After the war, he was still monstrously popular, precisely as an icon of how they chose to remember the war and chose to remember how everyone pulled together. But they voted him and his party out of office because they felt, well, the times now need a different kind of person, the times now need a different kind of policies. So I think, you know, we shouldn't assume that electorates are that dumb, that they can't actually differentiate from regarding someone as a symbolic figure as being different from, but who actually and how do you want the government being run? So, yeah, I mean, I think in this context, Putin is in some ways the engine that can drag the government along because, you're not very happy with it. But on the other hand, it's Putin's government. When Putin himself is at 60%, one can only guess at what the actual approval levels for the government itself are. So that's point number one. So, I mean, actually, it's not just about a third. It's a third of people who are willing to actually say, and I don't even like Putin as well.
Right.
But then more to the point, given that there are absolutely no meaningful mechanisms for dealing with that, it's not you can just simply say, well, we don't like this, but it's all right, we've got an election coming up in a year and we'll vote him out of office. You know, no one actually believes that the elections are really anything more than a symbolic act.
And this is a point Volkov makes in his piece
unity.
As well, yeah.
So you're left with a situation of either you just tune out, and if one looks, for example, currently at the sort of the Muscovite middle class, the kind of the Bolotnaya generation, shall we say, I mean, you know, it seems to me they're tuned out. They're desperately working out how they can get the hell out of the country, or they're just simply thinking politics, it's a dirty business, I'm not going to think about it, and I'm going to just think about my life and everything else. So either they tune out, which is actually quite corrosive when large numbers of people do it, or they start looking for alternative means of expressing their feelings. You know, civil society, truckers' protests, you know, whatever it is, it can take all kinds of different forms. And that's the whole point. When you lock the system down, that there are no acceptable valves through which the pressure can go, then at some point the pressure will burst out in unexpected, unpredictable, and quite possibly dangerous ways.
Sean, what do you think?
Yeah, these opinion polls, like comparing Putin's sky-high popularity compared to opinions about what the direction of the country and where's the government going and various reforms, it represents to me the kind of one of the central contradictions of the Putin system. And that is, the more his personal status is pumped up, it atrophies the mechanisms of governance to actually deal with people's dissatisfaction. So you have to – then you get the manifestation of, you know, like the FSO going out and handing out goodies.
Well, the whole Ruchnoye Upravlenie thing.
Yeah, exactly. Then Putin has to take, you know, manual control over the system and has to circumvent, you know, institutions and structures of governance, thereby further atrophying those things of making power. It breaks the connection without those using those levers and institutions. It breaks the communication between the people and the system. Mm-hmm. Therefore, they can only appeal directly to Putin personally. So it reproduces all of the kind of authoritarian structures of the personalized authoritarianism of the system at the expense of the state. So when you look at
it,
and this is the fundamental problem, because people may say, Russians may look and say, well, I like Putin as a person. He comes across as strong. He comes across as honest. He comes across as a good Russian. He's looking for our national interests. He represents us well internationally or domestically. We may just like his values. And also, one of the things that Volkov pointed out, there is no alternative.
Right.
Right. No, so basically, given the field of potentials out there, he's the best we got.
Well, he's the only thing they got, because if you remove – this is the fear that's in the elite, as well as
right.
An interesting interview with Valery Solovyov, a little bit off topic, but talking about how the elite views Putin right now. And he says they're hostages. They have Stockholm syndrome, because they know if they remove this guy, it's utter chaos because the state's dysfunctional.
Right. And this is the price you pay when everything gets flooded into the person of the leader rather than the institutions. And so there's kind of no way out here. So as Mark correctly point, the only way for dissatisfaction in society to break out is in these bursts, because the other normal mechanisms of governance don't really exist very well. They don't function very well.
I mean, everything I'm hearing tells me that we have to be coming towards a tipping point, although we keep saying this and it never, ever, ever, ever happens.
Russia's been run like this for a very, very, very long time.
With periodic tipping points,
but this has been the method of governance. I think we should separate the difference between governance and rule.
Mm-hmm.
The system of governance has been like this for a very, very long time. And after each tipping point, the next system gradually reproduces this.
The same thing. It's like
the interesting
boss
thing,
same as the old boss.
It's in some ways that the Communist Party was an interesting attempt, particularly in the post-Stalin times, to create a kind of collective czar, fulfilling the same function. But nonetheless, it was not one person. So you had all kinds of mechanisms, even things like the sort of great departments that were pouring through the letters to the party newspapers and such like. You know, all these different ways in which you could actually petition generic...
The collective czar.
exactly, the collective czar in that respect. So yeah, absolutely, we've seen this pattern replicate itself. And it can work. I wouldn't say especially efficiently, but all it needs to do is be efficient enough, especially when the virtue of this system is that it allows focuses of resources in a way that a more democratic one can't. If Putin turns around tomorrow and decides, actually, we're going to just abandon the tolls, it happens.
Right.
If Putin decides tomorrow that this particular city suddenly needs to have a new science park or whatever, you know, you look at what's going on, for example, in Tolyatti,
right.
You know, where to address the catastrophic
which was identified as one of the red zones by the FSO, by the way.
Precisely, because of this kind of catastrophic collapse of the domestic car industry,
yeah.
Which is there. So that they can start throwing money at the problem, which may or may not solve it, probably won't. But the point is, they can do it in a way that is actually very, very fast. And likewise, they can deploy violence and other forms of coercion very quickly without any kind of concerns. So actually, there is a certain kind of institutional durability that is created by this centralized government structure, but only in crisis management. The irony is it's rubbish for just general management of the state. And therefore, actually what happens is governance, I mean, absolutely, I agree with what Sean said about the, sort of the atrophying of governance. Governance becomes crisis management. And it's quite, unfortunately, it's good enough at that to handle it for quite some time until there's some kind of concatenation of shocks which come together to stop it. But that's what it's all about. It's all about sort of managing one problem and then moving on to the next and then moving on to the next.
One more thing before we move on. What do you make of the Hodorkovsky business? I mean, why bring fresh charges against this man now? I mean, we've got the situation where they bring new charges against Hodorkovsky in an old murder case of the mayor of Neftyugansk. Hodorkovsky comes out with a press conference that revolution in Russia is inevitable. They file new charges against him for calling for revolution in Russia. What is the point of that? What did you make? I mean, I gave my snap analysis on the Daily Vertical just as it's a sign of their insecurity that they need to go after. What do you make of this right now?
I'll be honest, I don't know,
Mark. It's a head scratcher, isn't it?
Like, quite baffled. And again, I think what it comes back to is, you know, we're going to try and explain it in grand political narrative terms. And it's very hard to find any kind of common sense reason, because it's not actually as if you're trying to discredit someone who has a massive constituency at home or anything like that, or that you honestly believe that the Western governments will say, oh, gosh, what? He's a murderer? Quickly, let's lock him up or whatever. I mean, it's very hard to find a common sense answer. And I suspect that that is the point. This is not a common sense thing. This is exactly... not just perhaps panicked or rattled, but also the actions of a government which precisely is handled by a relatively small number of people who are responding as human beings. Khodorkovsky has got their goat, and therefore they, in a spiteful, vindictive, and unfortunately for them, counterproductive manner, are continuing to wage this personal struggle against him. I don't think there's necessarily a grand narrative behind that.
I mean, contrasting to when he was released, remember back in December 2013, and we on this podcast, we discussed it. We agreed it was a sign that Putin feels confident right now because he can release. The Sochi Olympics were coming up. The protest movement had been squashed. The 2011-2012 protest movement had been squashed. The Sochi Olympics were coming up and Putin's numbers were going up. But this I could only interpret in the opposite way, that this is a sign of insecurity. Sean, what do you think?
I think on the one hand, there is somewhat of a desire to turn Hodorkovsky into the new Berezovsky, this kind of like grand master outside pulling strings, inside interfering in internal Russian politics, this kind of thing. But on the other hand, this next new round of charges, which they are quite baffling, I can't help but think of it as basically bureaucratic inertia, in the sense that they had this kind of investigation going on for a while, and it just kind of, you know, finally came out to some sort of actual
charges. Somebody would have to give the green light at a high place for that to happen.
Yes, certainly. But, you know, what do they care, slapping Hodorkovsky with another, you know, investigation, crime, or charges? I mean, you know, what difference does it make?
Right.
Nobody cares about him in the country, so it's just another kind of like jab in his face.
I mean, there were fears that he could start from abroad, financing the opposition and things like that. But it's still, it didn't make sense. If they did this in Navalny, I would understand.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting, because yesterday there was an article in Kommersant charging Navalny's investigation on Chaika with William Browder.
Uh-huh. Okay. That is interesting. I didn't see that.
Was behind or at least cooperating with Navalny's anti-corruption foundation to do this investigation of Chaika.
Well, that's a good way to segue into the second half, because I want to talk a little bit about Navalny's investigation into Chaika. In a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and look at the two types of entertainment that are battling for Russia's hearts and minds. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City is co-host Mark Eliade, a professor at NYU, an expert in Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow. Moscow Shadows. Also joining us via Skype from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies, author of Sean's Russia blog and host of the SRB podcast. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Вот на востоке Украины идет
это
война.
Артем Юрьевич Чайка.
Но это тоже война.
Сын генерального прокурора России.
Но воевать с Россией нет.
Артем Чайка и его коллеги, это не имеет никакого
Мрамор,
отношения.
Витражи, золото.
Это «Вести недели», и я, Дмитрий Киселев, добрый вечер.
Forget the television, forget the refrigerator. The real battle for Russia's soul, as I recently argued on the Daily Vertical, is between two types of proverbial porn. War porn and corruption porn. War porn arouses the population's anger against imaginary external enemies. Corruption porn tries, usually in vain, to stimulate their outrage against the very real excesses and abuses of their own kleptocratic rulers. War porn is produced by a massive, well-funded state media conglomerate and is amplified on state television. It stars the bombastic pro-Kremlin television presenter Dmitry Kiselyov. Corruption porn is a plucky internet startup and pops up periodically online. Its champion is opposition leader Alexei Navalny. War porn is based on fantasies. Corruption porn is a reality show, and so far the fantasy is winning. Mark, will it continue to do so?
Well, in some ways, exactly. This is the segue to the first part. I can't help but feel that there is a limit to how far the narratives of external threat can be played without some traction to the domestic world. Because in a way, what we have is, it's not just about war porn versus corruption porn as the sort of external enemies or internal enemies, shall we say. It's also about how far it can fit into people's personal day-to-day narratives. I mean, I think this is one of the reasons for the counter-sanctions that the Kremlin likes to levy. It makes people's lives a bit more miserable, but in some ways it also therefore involves them. That the whole issue of the external enemy is something that needs to be reenacted by society as a whole. And therefore, I think that the question is basically whether or not, and we've unfortunately been saying this for quite some time, whether or not actually the issue of corruption can be linked to people's day-to-day lives, which, of course, we know actually happens all the time. But the point is, too often, it's something that doesn't actually impinge. And again, this is where the truckers case is particularly significant, because exactly there is a very, very short line to be drawn from my truck, my little one-person business, is now in trouble because I now have to pay these tolls. And son of one of the richest guys, one of the closest guys to Putin, is pocketing 20%, probably more than that. But anyway, you know,
officially 20%,
a chunk of this money. Usually, you don't have quite such a straight line and a short line between, let's call it corruption, and people's day-to-day lives. So, in a way, war porn wins so long as it's competing against a corruption narrative that is quite airy-fairy and generalized and actually hard to really prove. It loses when either people start coming home in body bags. So in other words, you actually have a direct line between the costs of conflict and people's day-to-day lives, or when actually the corruption side of things can directly demonstrate the connection to people's day-to-day lives.
What did you make of Navalny's expose of Chaika? Because I thought this one stood out a little bit from his previous exposés. Not just that the video was slick and everything like that, but it seemed to get more traction. Did you notice? I mean, everybody noticed it. The camera settling in on Chaika when Putin was talking about corruption during his speech. That was no accident. This kind of got a little bit more traction than previous ones. What did you make of it?
Well, I mean, first of all, actually, I personally would discount that particular moment when the camera settled on Chaika. It would have been very weird. In fact, it would have been actually much more significant if, when Putin was talking about the need to crack down on corruption, given the way that they use the camera to sort of almost, you know, spotlight people, if they hadn't turned to the
prosecutor general, they could have turned to Pastrykin. They could have, you know, there's different places they could have turned.
Yeah, but I mean, again, historically, Chaika has this has tended to be one of Chaika's moments when they talk about the big corruption thing. So for me, though, but
in this context.
Yeah, I mean, in this context, if they hadn't, again, I think we would have been saying, isn't it interesting that they didn't look at Chaika? So that I would actually discount. But you actually had the case of Chaika being forced to make a public statement about it, and yes, mm-hmm. Say it was all a sort of a paid hit job and so forth. Presidential spokesman having to sort of say, even if it's just the banal points, as soon as something is said from the podium, metaphorical, of the presidential spokesperson, it makes it into a national story. So I agree that this has got more traction than before. And I think also because it happens to hit at a time when, like it or not, Putin has to talk about corruption. Mm. It might be that he's genuine this time. The boy who's cried wolf has actually seen it at the door. And this time, when he says it in State of the Federation address, that we've got to address corruption and there will be action, we'll wait and see. I'd love to think so, but it's hard to continue to be optimistic every single time. But the point is, so Putin has to, in some ways, address corruption at this point, and then you have this crop up.
Right. And the other interesting thing about this was that this was very specific allegations against very specific people that were extremely well documented about how Chaika's sons had used the office of the Prosecutor General's office to acquire a business empire in collusion with mobsters who committed a horrific murder a few years back, mass murder a few years back. You had Vedomosti checking out each and every one of these allegations and verifying them. So this is what I mean, where it's just got some traction. Sean, what was your takeaway from this?
Well, in terms of the traction, I think it partially has to do with the fact that Chaika, and maybe this is just my mistake in assuming this, is kind of considered one of the fairly clean ones, mm-hmm. like one of the professional ones.
Yeah.
He's not necessarily, he's not a Sechen. He's not kind of one of these dark figures that are just kind of collecting rents off the state. He comes across as a more kind of serious professional person in the prosecutor's office. That's not necessarily in the headlines. He's kind of in the back. So I think that this might have something to do with the fact, like, oh, my God, even him, another one that's we thought is a little bit better than the rest is also connected to all this stuff. But my thing is, and this goes to something Mark just says, is the limits of these exposés. Because, this is a big investigation. And in terms of elite politics in Russia, it's huge. In terms of the kind of reporting on the machinations of people connected to Putin, it's absolutely huge. It reveals a lot about the nature of the system and how powerful people, politically connected people, get their wealth and and allow their sons and daughters to do this as well. But, at the same time, Navalny also does all these exposés, and the Chaika thing had the same thing about, these villas that are in Europe and how they own all of this and they have all of
these
large mansions.
Well, that's the porn part.
And this is the porn part. And frankly, I imagine, because I do this, when I see these things, I'm like, yeah, so they have, large houses. I mean, of course they have our large houses. This is what powerful, well-connected, wealthy people
in kleptocracies have, right?
And so this goes to the point of, well, okay, fine. So Chaika is corrupt. Sechen is sucking rents off the state. So is a bunch of Putin's people getting really rich because they're connected to Putin. And that's just kind of the way Russia has worked. And you can see this, all over the place. But when you get it to, as Mark pointed out, that I'm this guy in my truck trying to make a living in a horrible situation, and now I have to pay one of Putin's friends.
Right.
This it's interesting that they've described this tax as extortion.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think this is a very important term. And when the corruption touches their lives, then you get a different type of understanding of it. And I'd actually like to ask Mark a question in terms of I've every once in a while I see corruption cases going on, but they're at the local level. So how does this kind of the anti-corruption campaign kind of playing out, in the places where the press isn't putting a lot of attention on it? And how visible is this? And I'm wondering how this plays in local media.
Well, I mean, first of all, to actually talk about the cases before talking about the local media. Again, what this says is that, and it's exactly the same with the fight against organized crime, there are cops, there are investigators, there are prosecutors who actually want to do their job. And when they get an opportunity, they go and investigate and press charges and so forth. And actually, not everything is a hit. Not everything is because of political machinations or someone has fallen out with someone else. Sometimes it's actually just simply that, you know, people within law enforcement are doing their job. The issue is more that you might say, when someone has the capacity to call in, they have a krisha somewhere else, they have the money or they have the protection or they have a friend in Moscow they can ring up or whatever, then the charges go away. So in some ways, it's essentially that the cases continue so long as nothing happens to stop them from doing so. Mm. And in terms of where that actually sort of means that it gets covered locally, is that you have almost two standard story arcs. One is the, as it were, the straightforward one, relatively low-level functionary gets caught, is embezzling or taking bribes or demanding bribes. And again, I think increasingly it's interesting we've moved, the model has moved back to a more extortionate, parasitic process, whereby particularly in the main cities, actually things had moved, sort of bribe-taking was much more a question of expediting rather than gatekeepers demanding. It had become a sort of a, you know, do you want the VIP service? Whatever. But no, I think now as financial pressures bite, we're back to people just simply thinking, how can I monetize my job? So you know, and that happens, and then it leads to a trial and some kind of a conviction, usually not the sort of the heaviest penalties, but actual penalties, and it's packaged as a small morality tale. And this is, I mean, actually very reminiscent of Soviet times. Mm. But then you have the ones which suddenly disappear halfway through. And that, for me, is particularly interesting. It's how the press handles that, because it very much says something, I mean, obviously about the different variations of individual journalists, how far they're willing to push it, individual editors and owners and everything else. And sometimes it just simply just disappears and it becomes a non-case. Sometimes there is some kind of flimsy rationale given as to why, oh, a mistake, actually, you know, mm-hmm. we found the money, it was behind the sofa, everything's fine. Or sometimes you actually, I mean, and again, this is why I want to link it to Chaika. The counter-narrative is, all along, this was a political hit. The law enforcement agencies found themselves, they were investigating this person, they thought they found a corrupt person, but it turned out in the end that this was all, you know, we're back to almost dramaturgia. You know, this was a rival had actually just simply been fabricating this. The individual is not just not guilty, but a poor innocent victim of the process. And so I think it's fascinating that Chaika himself actually has turned to this particular idiom of saying, not only am I not at all corrupt,
I'm the victim.
Actually, I'm the victim of dark forces. And I mean, on one level, I almost, and with all the caveats, feel a certain sympathy for him, because this is so carefully put together and so well resourced and things that it's hard not to suspect that some people
were providing that information. Let's stick with that for a second, because I actually had the same suspicions, at least that Navalny was working with somebody on the inside here, and not with Browder, with somebody on the inside. And who are Chaika's enemies in the law enforcement apparatus? Does he have any enemies? I'm not really familiar with him being a party to any clan battles. But you take a look at this a lot closer than I do.
Yeah, Chaika doesn't have obvious enemies. I mean, you know, he definitely does not get on well with Bastrykin, the investigations committee.
I don't think Navalny was working with Bastrykin.
No, well,
call me crazy.
even then, I mean, it was more that he had animus against Bastrykin, because Bastrykin basically wrenched the investigations committee out of, you know, being part of Chaika's empire. The thing about Chaika is that he has, I would say, few enemies, but no allies. Mm. One of his strengths has always been that on one level, actually, it's a, you know, he might get a snazzy uniform, but it's actually a fairly thankless task. Now that the investigations committee, which was actually the bit that always had the either political or financial opportunities attached to it. Much of the work with the Prosecutor General Office is very, very dull. And again, it means that you tend to actually crop up in the context of bad stuff. So it's not as if, you know, we've had a huge sign that other people were trying to take that over. But the point is, so, yeah, he was a moderately effective, not terribly effective, I think, actually, but moderately effective enough, let's put it that way, technocrat, in a job that no one else really cared about or wanted. That was his greatest strength. In some ways, he was the sort of Medvedev of the Siloviki.
That's brilliant. But so nobody has any reason to take this guy down.
Well, nobody has any reason to take him down that we know of. But I mean, I think there are sort of two possibilities. One is, let's assume that there is going to be something done about corruption, not necessarily a genuine anti-corruption campaign, but let's say all of a sudden that a decision has been made that 2016 is going to seize a few high-profile cases. Is going to, you know, they at least want to be able to give the appearance that they're taking it seriously. At that point, the potential is that, in fact, the Prosecutor General's office becomes more important. So it could be actually a preemptive attempt to put someone, you know, get someone in there, take it over, or at least just get someone who's more, you know, part of one of the existing clans. So that's possibility number one. Possibility number two is, you know, we always look at institutions, whereas in fact these are human beings. You know, just as with Khodorkovsky, it could just simply be that just Chaka, you know, pissed someone off, and they decided, because, you know, it's fairly clear that from time to time Navalny has had help from some people. You know, no doubt. I mean, again, I'm not for a minute suggesting that he's just some kind of stooge, but, you know, through whatever cutouts, files must appear. Yeah. And just someone thought, okay, right, you know, this is my useful weapon against you. I'm going to make your life miserable by demonstrating that you're in fact just as dirty as everyone else.
I saw an interesting poll, as we're bumping up against the end, but I wanted to get to this before we wrapped it up. I saw an interesting poll in Levada this week showing that 80% think that Putin should take responsibility for the corruption, for tackling corruption. It was very interestingly worded. Interested, not do you think Putin is responsible for the corruption happening, but is this something that Putin should take responsibility for? In other words, it's his problem, right? 80% think that, and that's interesting.
What do you mean by that in terms of his problem, in the sense of it's his political?
Yeah, he's the one that's responsible. He should be solving this.
He should personally take this as the issue.
It's not like is Putin the cause of the corruption, but is this something that is really something that Putin is responsible for solving? And the corollary of that is, if it's not solved, it's his fault, right? Yeah. And that combined with the anti-corruption rhetoric in Putin's speech. Do you think is this something that Putin is personally vulnerable on?
Well, it's interesting because it does pose this much more as a moral question. So, you know, whereas previous Levada polls, I mean, have often asked questions in much more specific, you know, how far exactly do you think Putin is personally involved in corruption, or actually is involved with the people who are corrupt and that kind of thing. So, in other words, trying to draw direct connections, and people often think not. Because, again, he is this elevated figure. Now this is actually shifting it to precisely, given how Putin has created this personalized political system, who else... You know, who else can you turn to? Who are you going to call? And so I think it does create vulnerabilities. And the problem is, Putin himself is, and I don't think we necessarily need to shed any tears for him, has created this problem. In that not only has he indeed allowed a kleptocratic system to emerge.
He's encouraged it.
But also, he has periodically invaded against it. Sometimes for direct political reasons, sometimes because he just hopes to sort of, through just a bit of rhetoric, make the issue go away for him. But nonetheless, I mean, he has created this issue that Putin talks about corruption, and people expect him to be saying bad things about it and how terrible it is. How often can you continue to say corruption's bad and this year we're really going to do something about it without actually doing something about it? And then you find yourself in a position in which, precisely because of the economic crisis, corruption has become more visible, more predatory. That at a point where, actually, for a lot of people, corruption no longer directly impacted their lives. It impacted indirectly in the sense of, you know, massive embezzlement, so the hospital's not as clean and the school isn't as, you know, hasn't been rebuilt and whatever. But again, we're back to this question of people being able to draw a direct line. Now we're back to that situation of the traffic cop stopping you and demanding a bribe, the local bureaucrat saying, you need this stamp on that form, and frankly, I'm not going to sort of pull out my ink pad until you push an envelope my way. So at the very time when corruption is once again impacting on people's lives, that's when people turn to the good czar. And he's once again chosen to make it a big platform, a pillar of his State of the Federation address. But I don't know if he's got it in him to really do anything about it.
I don't think it's a matter of what's in him. I don't think he can do anything about it because it's the fuel of the whole system. I mean, as you said, this tripartite state that you've talked about in the past, where you have this normal state that just does its job, but that can be trumped at any moment by the kleptocracy. When the kleptocracy are the people that are running the show, they can reach in at any time. He can't pull this out. He can't do anything. He can only do something cosmetic.
And given these poll numbers, he can't fix it.
This is my point. With these poll numbers saying 80% think he's responsible for this and should be doing something. 80%, and yet he cannot, right?
Which is almost like, actually, I mean, you're suggesting that in some ways the Stockholm syndrome is the other way.
Yeah,
well, it's actually Putin is in some ways now the captive of his elite. I honestly think there are things he could do. Of course, he can't, he won't, he doesn't want to actually fix the system and cleanse the system or whatever. He could do the classic approach of squeezing down the level of corruption and making some high-profile, you know, sort of arrests and real convictions, rather than the sort of Serdyukov-type case where things just kind of fizzle out and, oh, but here's a very well-paying sinecure for you. The problem is that, and again, it's one of these paradoxes, the extent to which Putin is happy to launch cruise missiles across the world, but actually in domestic politics, he's strikingly risk-averse. Mm. And I think this is why he hasn't got, well, I say he hasn't got it in him. There are things he can do without completely collapsing the system. But I just think that I don't think he's up for the kind of fight with the elite that would involve. Mm.
Sean, last word to you before we wrap it up.
Yeah, I mean, I think this goes back to the kind of the beginning of our conversation today. And that is Putin is caught, you know, he is in some, not to be sympathetic, but he is a prisoner of this very system that he's created. And since he's come back for his third term and has adopted this very populist rhetoric, he's even more in prison because now, in order to satisfy one of the constituencies, he has to squeeze the other, mm-hmm. right? On both ends, right? And in decreasing economic prosperity, the elites that, you know, before were using corruption as a way to expedite services or to take rents, with less of the pie to go around, they have to squeeze society harder to get more. But that creates dissatisfaction amongst society, who are right. demanding the president, Putin, because this is the only guy that they believe in, to do something about it. So he is, in a way, a prisoner of that the complexity and paradoxes of the Putin system.
So everybody has Stockholm syndrome. Everybody's a hostage.
In a way, yeah.
And on that note, we'll wrap it up. That's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you that you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City has been co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at NYU, an expert on Russian security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And joining us via Skype from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, has been Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh's Center for Russian Eastern European Studies, author of Sean's Russia blog and host of the SRB podcast. Thank you, gentlemen, for an enlightening discussion.
Always fun.
Thank you.
It is always fun. I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my indispensable colleague, Pavel Butorin, senior producer for RFRL's Russian language television program, Current Time, whom you can follow on Twitter at Pasha Butorin. I'd also like to remind you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.